look at your hand for a second. I mean, if you're driving, maybe just glance at the steering wheel, but, you know, think about your hand.
Yeah, it feels incredibly permanent, right?
Exactly. It seems solid.
Yeah.
You recognize the texture of the skin, the lines on your palm, maybe a scar from when you were a kid. You think of it very clearly as, like, your hand.
Right. But physically, biologically speaking, almost none of the atoms making up that hand were there a few years ago.
Which is wild to think about. You are literally made of entirely different materials today than you were a decade ago.
Oh, entirely.
So it begs this massive question. Why is it still your hand? Like, what is actually persisting there?
That is the perfect starting point.
Yeah. So I want to start today's deep dive by asking you, the listener, the central underlying question behind that whole mystery. It's kind of the ultimate chicken or the egg problem for the very fabric of reality.
Here we go.
Which comes first? The parts or the relation?
It's the question that completely breaks our everyday intuition once you really start pulling at the thread. Because common sense gives us what feels like an incredibly obvious answer.
Right.
We all harbor this deeply rooted mental framework. Philosophers call it a substantialist mindset.
Which is basically the Lego block universe, right?
That is a great way to visualize it, yeah. We instinctively imagine the universe as this giant cosmic toy box filled with independent Lego blocks.
Right. So you've got atoms, you've got biological cells, you've got people.
Exactly. And we assume these distinct blocks exist first, completely on their own, and then, you know, occasionally they bump into each other and shake hands to form a relationship.
Right. Like you exist, I exist, and this conversation we are having is just some secondary event that happens to us.
Exactly. It's a very comforting thought, honestly.
Because it gives everything a solid inherent essence. But, the mission of this deep dive is to completely blow up that Lego block view of the universe.
Oh, we are dismantling it entirely today.
Because when you look at our sources for this dive, covering modern physics, biology, and some of the most profound philosophical traditions in human history, that intuitive common sense is actually a fundamental illusion.
Right. The handshake doesn't happen between the pre-existing Legos.
The handshake actually creates the Legos.
Yeah.
The relation precedes the parts.
And to really prove that, we have to go down to the absolute foundational level of reality. We have to look at physics, because physics is, you know, the ultimate study of stuff.
Right. And for a long time, classical physics totally validated our everyday intuition.
It did. We treated the atom like a tiny, solid billiard ball. It was the ultimate indivisible Lego brick of the universe. You could track its speed. You could pinpoint its location.
It was a noun.
Exactly, a noun.
That's the classic model we all learned in grade school. But there was a massive reality-bending shift that happened when we started looking deeper into the subatomic realm.
Yeah, when we looked close enough, the thing literally evaporated.
It's just gone. Because if you dive into quantum field theory, or QFT, it shows us that what we've been calling a particle for the last century is actually just a localized vibration in a continuous field.
Right. Think of the universe as a giant, invisible guitar string.
Okay, I like that.
An electron isn't a tiny bead of plastic sitting on the string. The electron is the note that gets played when the string vibrates.
Wow. So the electron has absolutely no independent existence outside of the field.
None. And the field is pure relation. An electron isn't a tiny piece of substance that, like, possesses the properties of charge and mass. It is a set of relationships occurring within a field.
So if you silence the vibration, if that relationship ceases,
the electron doesn't just sit there deactivated, waiting to be turned back on. It disappears entirely.
That is so trippy. The part relies entirely on the relation to even exist.
And if you want to push the substantialist mind even further to the breaking point, we really have to talk about quantum entanglement.
Oh, man. This completely breaks my brain every time I try to visualize it.
I know. It's tough. So you have two particles that interact and become entangled. Once they are entangled, they begin to behave as a single unified system, completely regardless of the physical distance between them.
Right. So if you change the spin state of one particle, the other particle responds instantly, not a millisecond later. Instantly.
Exactly. Even if they are on opposite sides of the observable universe.
Which just shatters the idea that things are isolated objects trapped in spatial boxes.
Completely. Entanglement proves that you can have relation without distance. The relationship between those two particles is actually more fundamentally real than their existence as separate entities occupying space.
Wow.
In fact, modern physics is increasingly pointing toward the idea that space itself might just be an emergent property of these underlying quantum relations.
Wait, really? So space isn't an empty stage where parts are placed.
No, space is the geometry generated by the network of relationships.
That brings up Carlo Rovelli. He's one of the key champions of this idea in our sources. He's a physicist who put together something called relational quantum mechanics, or RQM.
Yeah, and his take on this fundamentally rewrites how we understand reality. Rovelli's work forces us to abandon the idea of isolated essence.
Right, because in RQM, you literally cannot ask what a particle is in isolation.
The math doesn't even allow it. You can only ask how it affects something else during a physical interaction.
So a particle doesn't even possess properties?
No. It doesn't have a specific position, it doesn't have a momentum, it doesn't even have a boundary until it interacts with another physical system. The interaction acts as a mirror that forces the property to manifest.
So the interaction itself is the information. Without the interaction, there's no thing to measure.
Right.
It's like a chameleon that doesn't actually have a color until you look at it. But taking this a step further, it doesn't even have a body until it bumps into a leaf.
That's a brilliant way to put it. The physical world is just a vast, infinite net of interactions. And what we call objects are merely the temporary nodes where these interactions intersect.
So the correlation of information is the reality. There is no hidden microscopic substance carrying that correlation on its back.
Exactly. But human nature fights this tooth and nail.
Oh, for sure. If physics tells us there are no solid billiard balls down there, our instinct is to just grab a bigger shovel and dig deeper.
We constantly try to peel back the layers of reality like an onion, searching for the ultimate what of the world.
We are totally obsessed with finding the underlying substrate.
We really are. We assume that if we can just isolate the absolute smallest piece of stuff, you know, the final foundational brick, the mystery of existence will be solved.
But pushing down to the substrate explains absolutely nothing about our actual experience.
It's a complete dead end.
Let me try an analogy here from the source material to see if I'm tracking with this. It feels like trying to understand the rules of baseball by putting a baseball under an electron microscope.
Oh, I love this one.
Right. If you want to know what a home run is, you might decide to grind the baseball down to its fundamental parts. You analyze the dust, and you find leather, you find twine, cork, carbon atoms.
But no matter how closely you look at those carbon atoms, you will never, ever find a home run.
Exactly. The home run isn't inside the ball. The home run only exists in the relationships, the rules of the game, the layout of the field, the swinging of the bat, the gravity of the stadium.
That captures the illusion perfectly. We constantly mistake the container for the contents. Looking at the wood of a lectern doesn't explain the human act of holding a book.
Right, and looking at the silicon in a microchip doesn't explain the mathematical act of calculating.
You can map every single neural pathway in the human brain, trace every firing synapse, and you still will not have captured the subjective lived experience of a thought.
Because the physical firing of the neurons is just the ritual that the structure performs so the thought can emerge.
Exactly.
But I'm not letting go of this that easily. I want to push back because there is a very natural fear here.
Sure. Lay it on me.
If the substrate doesn't hold the essence of the thing, and if everything is just a relationship without any solid stuff at the bottom, isn't that just a ghost world?
A ghost world?
Yeah. A universe made of empty void. I mean, if I walk into a doorframe, I stub my toe. That hurts.
Oh, absolutely.
My toe isn't the ghost, and the doorframe isn't a ghost. How do I get a bruised knee from an empty void?
That bruised knee is exactly why the substantialist mind rebels against this. But we have to redefine what empty means in this context.
Okay, how so?
In a relational framework, empty does not mean a dark void of nothingness. It means empty of independent essence.
Oh, I see.
It means it is incredibly full of relations. The universe isn't a collection of objects sitting on a foundation. It is a continuous roaring performance.
Wow.
To look for a permanent essence in a substrate is like looking for a dancer inside a set of footprints.
The footprints are the evidence of the dance, but they aren't the dance itself.
Precisely. And this realization completely dissolves one of the most stubborn philosophical nightmares in human history.
The mind-body problem, the Cartesian split.
Yes. René Descartes and the famous hard problem of consciousness. Mind versus matter.
Descartes formally defined matter and consciousness as two fundamentally different, completely independent substances, right?
He did. He called them extended stuff and thinking stuff. But the moment you define them as mutually exclusive essences,
two totally different kinds of Legos,
you build an impenetrable wall between them. The substantialist is left trying to build a bridge across a gap that their own definitions artificially created.
Because if matter is inherently dead and unconscious, you can't just mash carbon and oxygen atoms together until they magically spark into self-awareness.
No, they are logically sealed off from each other, so we end up with these extreme workarounds.
Right, like materialists try to claim the mind doesn't really exist, that it's just an illusion generated by atoms.
And idealists try to claim matter doesn't exist, that the door frame you stubbed your toe on is just a projection of the mind.
Both of those frameworks fail because they are still desperately searching for a single box to cram all of reality into.
Exactly. They want one fundamental substrate. But if we rely on dependent arising, the idea that neither matter nor mind has a fixed core, that impenetrable Cartesian wall vanishes.
Mind and matter aren't two different things trying to awkwardly interact. They're two different ways of describing a single, seamless interaction.
Like the heads and tails of a single coin.
Right. They are distinct in their function, but they arise together simultaneously.
Yeah.
You can't mint a coin with only one side.
And you don't need to reduce the mind to the body or the body to the mind.
Yeah.
Because they are empty of inherent isolated essence, they are fundamentally relational.
Diversity is maintained without needing to crush everything down into one underlying substance.
Exactly.
Okay, let's reset and address that bruised knee again, because we still have a practical problem here.
Fair enough.
There is no substrate. There are no fundamental Lego blocks, just pure activity and performance. But the door frame still feels completely solid.
Right.
If reality is just pure activity, how do we get things out of a web of verbs?
The answer lies in the concept of regularity. It's really a trick of human language and perception. Think of a river.
Okay, river.
If you walk down to a fast-moving river, you might see a whirlpool. You point at it and you give it a noun. You say, look at that whirlpool. You talk about it as if it's a solid object sitting in the water.
Right, but the whirlpool has no essence.
Exactly. It is made entirely of the interaction of water currents. The actual water molecules are constantly flowing through it, changing every single millisecond.
So the whirlpool only exists as a specific set of relational dynamics.
Yes.
And if that water stops flowing, the water molecules are still there, but the thing vanishes. The whirlpool doesn't pack up and move downstream.
No, the function that was the whirlpool simply ceases to be. In a field of pure, chaotic activity, certain patterns of interaction become stable enough over time that human perception can recognize them.
And we designate these stable regularities using what philosophers call conventions.
That's right. We give these stable nodes names. We call them an atom, a table, a door frame, or a person. But we suffer from a profound grammar of illusion.
We use static nouns to describe a world that is made entirely of active verbs.
We name the whirlpool because it's convenient for communication, but then we trick ourselves into believing the name implies a solid substance.
Oh man, so the doorframe is just a very, very slow-moving whirlpool of quantum fields.
Exactly. It is a deeply stable pattern of regularity, and biologists have had to actively unlearn the noun-based view of the world to understand life.
Like the thinkers, Evan Thompson and Francisco Varela in our sources.
Yes, they developed a brilliant framework called inactivism. They showed that a biological cell doesn't exist because it possesses some magical life substance.
Right, a cell enacts its own boundary through its processes.
Yeah.
Let's unpack the mechanics of that because it's fascinating.
Let's do it.
A single-celled amoeba isn't just a tiny sack of jelly sitting in a puddle. It is actively distinguishing between food and not food.
Right. By taking in nutrients, metabolizing them, and expelling waste, those continuous chemical reactions literally build the semi-permeable membrane that separates the amoeba from the outside water.
The action of eating and living creates the actor.
Thompson and Varela use a beautiful phrase for this. They call it laying down a path in walking.
The path doesn't exist waiting for the walker, and the walker isn't a walker without the path.
Exactly. The identity of the cell and its environment co-emerge simultaneously through the action.
This maps so perfectly onto some of the oldest spiritual philosophies in the world, specifically in the Zen tradition.
Oh, absolutely.
Dogen Zenji, operating in the Madhyamaka tradition centuries ago, taught the exact same principle. It's the concept of designation by relation.
Dogen is a perfect parallel here. He taught a principle called Shusho Ito, which translates to the oneness of practice and realization.
Right, because a substantialist approaching meditation thinks they're going to sit on a cushion in order to acquire enlightenment.
As if enlightenment is a state or a glowing substrate they can possess and put in their pocket.
But Dogen argued that the sitting is the enlightenment.
Exactly. The function of sitting is the essence of being a Buddha. There is no hidden mystical substrate behind the deed.
The walking is the walker. The dance is the dancer.
It forces you to completely reevaluate what it means to be something.
I am totally on board with the whirlpools, the verbs, and the amoebas. But I have to bring up the final boss of this deep dive, the ultimate hurdle.
Uh-oh, here it comes.
If things are just stable verbs, if they're just conventions, how can there be interaction or cause and effect if there are no things doing the interacting?
Yes.
How is causality maintained without what philosophers call relata, you know, the pre-existing things themselves?
It is arguably the most difficult conceptual leap to make when you abandon substantialism. Our language makes it nearly impossible to talk about an action without an actor.
It feels like trying to describe a collision without two cars.
Exactly.
But there is a mathematical way to solve this from the sources that actually translates perfectly to physical reality.
Let's hear it.
Think about the most basic mathematical function, y equals f of x. In math, the variables x and y are not physical entities. They aren't pieces of stuff. They are completely empty buckets.
Right. They are purely positions in a relational structure. They have no mass, no volume, no inherent meaning at all until the function defines them.
Right. Yet, if I change x, y must change. There is absolute ironclad causal power in that equation.
And this proves that causal power does not require physical stuff. It arises entirely from the structure of the relations themselves.
You don't need solid billiard balls to have cause and effect.
No, you don't. And to bring that back to the bruised knee on the doorframe, the electromagnetic fields of the atoms in your knee and the atoms in the doorframe are essentially mathematical probabilities pushing against each other.
So the repulsion, the pain, that is the math happening. That is the function executing.
Precisely. And the philosopher Karen Barad takes that exact structural reality and gives us a new vocabulary for it.
Right, her concept of the agential cut.
Yes. Barad argues that we shouldn't even use the word interaction anymore.
Because interaction automatically implies two pre-existing Lego blocks coming together in space.
Exactly. Instead, she coined the term interaction.
Interaction. Okay, so help me visualize the core difference there.
Think of a completely still pond. The surface is like glass. Now, imagine you drag a stick through the water. You create two distinct ripples that bounce off each other and form a complex pattern.
Right.
Before the stick moved, there weren't two ripples waiting under the surface, waiting to interact. The action of the stick itself cut the water into interacting parts. That is interaction.
Oh, wow. The movement itself creates the boundary.
Yes. The interaction isn't something that happens between a subject and an object. The interaction is the process that gives rise to the appearance of the subject and the object in the first place.
So the act of the cut is what draws the temporary boundary in an otherwise seamless field of activity.
Causality doesn't happen between things. Causality is the engine that generates the things.
So to synthesize this massive journey we've just taken, we started with a universe of independent Lego blocks. And we've watched that dissolve into a universe that is a seamless, roaring ocean of activity.
And we've seen through quantum field theory that parts literally disappear without their relational fields.
We've learned that pushing down to find a foundational substrate explains absolutely nothing, because you can't find a home run inside the atoms of a baseball.
Exactly.
We've realized that our nouns, our tables, doors, and bodies are just helpful linguistic conventions for deeply stable patterns, like whirlpools in a river.
Fundamentally, inescapably, the relations precede the parts.
And if we bring this directly back to you, the listener, and that hand you were looking at earlier, the implications for your own life are pretty staggering.
Oh, they change everything.
Yeah.
We almost always think of ourselves as a stable substance, a fixed identity moving through time. You know, I am this kind of person, I have these traits.
But the water in your bodily whirlpool has completely cycled out. Your atomic structure is entirely new.
What persists is not the stuff. What persists is your pattern, your deeply ingrained relational dynamics.
You are not an isolated competing entity looking out at the world through a window from inside your skull.
No, you are an interdependent performance, inextricably linked to your environment. Your boundary is being enacted moment by moment by how you interact with the world around you.
You are the relation.
Exactly.
It's dizzying, but it's also incredibly liberating.
Yeah.
And it leads to a final provocative thought that I want to leave you with today.
Let's hear it.
If our reality, including our own identity, our neuroses, our habits, our limitations, is not a fixed substance, but just a web of deeply ingrained patterns, then structure isn't permanent.
It's just a settled habit of enactment, a very slow-moving whirlpool.
And habits, no matter how deeply entrenched, can be broken.
Yeah.
This introduces the idea of the catalyst from our sources.
Right. A catalyst could be a sudden philosophical realization, maybe even a shift in perspective from a deep dive like this one.
Or it could be a drastic shift in your physical environment or your social circles. But a catalyst acts as a disruption to the pond.
Because you are not made of permanent solid blocks, a catalyst can break the momentum of your habitual tendencies.
It forces a new agential cut. It allows the performance of your life to shift and an entirely new pattern of existence to emerge from the web.
Because there is no rigid, unchangeable substrate holding you back, transformation isn't just possible. It is the natural, inevitable result of changing how you interact with the world.
It's time to let go of the Lego bricks. The universe is a handshake that creates the hands. So look at your hand one more time and ask yourself this. What catalyst might disrupt the deeply ingrained patterns of your own reality today?